This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Please remember to keep good personal hygiene and keep following the latest advice from the government and the World Health Organization.
Offer a helping hand to the less fortunate than us, even if it's something like helping with their shopping or running small errands. But generally, the less fortunate need our help at this point, and we should be doing all that we can. So try to help, try to talk, and together we'll get through it.
It's important for us as teammates to keep together, and same for the fans as well, to keep together and united through this.
We need to look out for each other now more than ever. We need to help those who need help. We are the Aston Villa family and we support our own.
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now, so I'll play it for you. It's called My Old Man.
Out it comes to McGinn!
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast. I'm David Michael, the editor of myoldmansaid.com and your host, as per usual. Joining me for our first show since the coronavirus has changed the face of football and society as we know it, Mr. Chris Bird, welcome.
Hello.
And from Northern Ireland, Mr. Phil Shaw, welcome back.
Hello.
The last time I spoke about a virus was to Gwyneth Paltrow, Matt Damon, for that film Contagion 9 years ago at Venice Film Festival, when I used to go to film festivals and interview actors and directors or whatever.
I think we all know that it's possible that something like that could happen. But my brother read an article in the New York Observer about like 10 or 12 years ago about where they sent a doctor out to swab surfaces in Manhattan. Like a clean glass at a five-star restaurant, the subway, you know. And he was like, he was so freaked out by this article. And he had me read, and he's like, there's feces on everything. And there's staph on everything. There's E. coli on a clean glass. And I was like, what? So for 10 or 12 years, I have been a hand washer from that article. So this didn't really...
So was the disease where you...
OCD. No, I don't have that. I don't have that, but I am aware of, you know, how dirty everything is.
9 years ago, you're just thinking about, you think you're talking about a concept that, oh, it could happen. And that's, you know, that's how you talk about it. And here we are 9 years later, and you watch that film and you're like, whoa, it's pretty much exactly what's happened, from the disease or the virus starting in the animal markets in China or Asia. I can't remember exactly, but it's from a bat, isn't it, in the film as well, if you've seen it.
I haven't seen the film.
Yeah, I think bat droppings into some other animal's food and then it mixes.
Yeah, and that's pretty much exactly what's happened. And here we are, and it's getting more serious by the day. And especially when you look at places like Italy, which is a few weeks ahead in terms of how the curve is shaping up. And you get a little insight into where any other country, you know, like the UK or wherever else you're listening, is kind of heading. So what's going to happen to Mayo Man Said? Well, Mayo Man Said happens, whatever happens, unless they cut off the internet. Then
we live in a permanent state of self-isolation, David, so...
We may have a problem if they cut off the internet, but we will be here like during the war time, where you used to huddle around the wireless to get updates and news. We will give you, as well as what's happening with Villa, a bit more of a context, maybe in terms of Birmingham as well. I'm going to speak to somebody who's a cafe owner in a future show who will give us a context of how it's hitting Birmingham's local trade, a Villa fan. We'll give you some reality rather than just some kind of, you know, just bullshit and quizzes and, you know, shite like that. Coming up in this show, we will use the 3 points to give us a bit of context of how this coronavirus is affecting football thus far, from the league obviously being suspended, the likelihood of when it will start, and then how the various levels of the football pyramid have reacted to the news. In terms of Villa, the main body of the show, we will be talking about how this break has impacted on Villa. Is it a blessing in disguise, if there is such a thing? And obviously at this point we're talking hypothetically in terms of how this, if this season will pan out and end, or if it unfortunately will have to be voided because it stretches past the summer. Right, gentlemen, how are you anyway? How is everybody?
I'm sure I speak for all of us when it's just think, what a strange time we live in. This is, you know, something none of us have experienced before. You know, none of us are old enough to remember like wartime, but this is just unprecedented, isn't it? I mean, I sit in a studio all day and work on my own anyway, so in terms of I'm used to living in a state of isolation, but in terms of the general, you know, being able to go out and do things is, you know, being limited more and more. All my gigs have been cancelled. It's just a strange time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, me too, as I've always been freelance for, you know, coming up to like two decades now. So and most of the time I work from home, so there isn't that, you know, there isn't a seismic change for me, but you know, if you've got kids and stuff, it's a whole new ball game. And obviously a lot of people with their work very much with a question mark over it, people losing jobs or having to take unpaid leave as well.
You've got a whole company's going out of business.
That's the thing. I mean, there was this attitude that it's, you know, it's not serious. And, you know, you hear people say, oh, when football comes back, well, you know, maybe football doesn't come back. As you know, there's this attitude that, oh, a couple of weeks and we'll be back at it. But, they don't close down the aviation links. They don't seal off borders unless it's like real, real serious. And, you know, I know people in like the pharmaceutical and medical trade and also in engineering that have got government contracts, and some of the things they're having to build or been requested to price for are, as the guy said to me, you know, it left a lump in his throat. So it is serious. So, but anyway, let's talk about it in a football context by starting with the 3 points. The first point really sets the stage for the domestic leagues that UEFA put back the 2020 Euros back a year to 2021. I think there was a lot of lobbying probably by the domestic leagues to, rather than dwell on it on a month-to-month basis, to, right, let's just, because there's no World Cup the following year, just, you know, let's just put it back, and that frees up the back-end months to complete domestic leagues. And it gives, you know, the leagues, then they can play it month by month rather than having like a cutoff point, because they know the Euros is there. So it was a sensible thing, wasn't it, all round?
It was the obvious move, just, wasn't it? I don't think there weren't too
just
many
sort of get, gives them all breathing space.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of spreading a pandemic, having a European-wide tournament has kind of come back to bite them, really. This idea of expanding. And, you know, I just like the idea of these tournaments to be hosted in one country. I wasn't that big on this idea of spreading it across Europe.
No.
Although I see the ideology, but you lose that kind of special flavour of a tournament, especially if you're a fan of a country and you go to the games. You want to experience what Denmark is like if it's hosted in Denmark. the whole thing, or, you know, in Spain or whatever.
Well, you want a tournament to reflect the culture and the identity of the place you're being hosted by. You know, Russia in the last World Cup, you know, everybody went there expecting, you know, to be get their heads kicked in and were shitting themselves, and everybody who went out there said it was brilliant.
Yeah, and you get to experience a culture properly over. Or like
when it was in, you know, like when they had the World Cup in Japan and Korea, you know, you experience, some people are probably experiencing a culture they would never normally have a reason. Yeah. Well, you know, there's obviously always a reason, but they would never normally go to Japan or Korea or some of these countries.
But anyway, it'll be interesting to see if they do this setup again for the Euros. Anyway, that brings us on to point number two, where the Premier League and EFL and all the other major football bodies, what do they call it, the top level, top tier of football, have all agreed in a meeting. And it was more a brainstorming meeting. I don't think anybody is in a position at this moment to offer sacrosanct timings on anything. They have agreed to put the Premier League and other leagues back to April 30th. That is more a date for biding time to see how it goes. So it gives them a chance to think about how this is going to play out in terms of dates, etc. So provisionally they will knock some dates up, as i.e. the fixture list for the rest of the season, but also B, it gives them more time to come up with other alternate plans if it's pushed back another month or 2 months, 3 months, or if they have to void it. They will obviously come up with some ideas.
Because their general stance is that they will finish the league whatever, isn't it, at the moment? That's the general line.
It's not whatever. It's like, in an ideal world, they would like to finish the league. They can't finish it by hook or crook, because if this virus, you know, gets worse and worse, you know, it's, you got to avoid it. But considering the government are reacting day to day, you can't really expect the Premier League to come up with anything written in stone. I mean, when you look at the music scene, for example, all gigs are starting to be cancelled that will take place in April, and that will surely soon be applying to gigs that happen in May. I mean, you just have to look at that. Glastonbury's already gone. That's a June thing. Cannes Festival, the biggest film festival, which normally runs from May 12th to 23rd, or those are the dates this year, that's been postponed, and they're looking for like June, July as an alternate date, which even that I think is a bit optimistic. I've got a couple of sisters who work in pharma, and they get updates from the Royal Medical Commission, and the earliest they have been told anything could happen in terms of a relaxation on public gatherings or whatever, you know, they've been kind of saying, and this is optimistic, they're saying like late May, June. So anybody like Michael Owen made me laugh. These footballers haven't got, you know, real half a brain. They shouldn't be in the media anyway. But Michael Owen tweets, after today's announcement, it looks like the Premier League could be back at the end of April, which would obviously be great news, as it would mean we're over the worst of the coronavirus.
Yeah, thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael, for that. You know, actually do some research. The Premier League's just buying time. They have to. That's the only thing they can do. And they have to do it systematically, you know, week by week by week. I'm sure we'll get to the start of April. And I mean, as I say, it changes daily, but every week, I mean, the difference of a week next week will be completely different to what we're looking at. So the Premier League might even make an announcement next week and say, Plan B was, May, end of May or whatever. So that's what we're going for.
Because you're not just factoring in, it's not like you get the all clear from the government on the Monday and by the Tuesday you can play matches, is it? They'll have a duty of care for, you know, infrastructure, staff, etc., all the policing and medical needs that come with hosting matches. Players will have obviously basically been sat on their arse for the best part of 6 to 8 weeks, potentially. You know, while they're finely tuned athletes, you can't just go from 0 to 100, because that's what will happen with the fixtures, isn't it? They'll try and put as much into maybe a 6 week period to put 10, 11 rounds of matches in.
No, you see, people talking about playing behind closed doors. I mean, the PSG Dortmund match was played behind closed doors, and they still needed 500 people in the stadium to actually facilitate that. So
along with them, thousands of fans, weren't they, outside still?
Yeah, but they, in terms of that, the one theory is to play out the rest of the season within a few weeks, but at neutral stadiums, so fans
or just
wouldn't
play them at training grounds.
Like, for example, you play them in Birmingham or the Midlands because it's like a halfway house. But I think these are all a thinking out loud talk, and I don't think it's because there's money and broadcasting at stake here. This is why they're really stretching for answers here, because safety is and health is the number one thing, and you have to take that very seriously. I mean, I don't want to scandalize or anything, but people that I know work for engineering companies and big ones that one would do aircraft engines, but all these manufacturing engineering companies of like high level have been asked to diversify and tender a bid to do these ventilators, because we have like 7,000, they want 20,000 extra ones, and this shows you what's how serious. And ventilators will be used for people obviously in intensive care, because it's a respiratory issue, so that's this kind of scale. And there's other things that the government want building, and they're like quarantine buses and actually incinerators as well, and like mobile morgues. So this is the kind of scale we're looking at, and it's kind of quite nihilistic. I mean, as the guy said to me when he saw the proposal he got via email, there was a lump in his throat, and he was like, well, I've never seen anything like this. It was pretty macabre stuff, but it's like it's when sentiment kind of goes out the window. You are just practically trying to meet head on a pandemic, which is pretty fucking serious, to be sure. So when you look at people like Michael Owen, I mean, I don't want to get Michael Owen, it's just indicative of a lot of people who have taken this a bit lightly. They're staying at home doing keep me ups with toilet rolls, while on the front line you've got nurses, doctors, GPs at real risk. You've also you've got the people trying to keep the supply lines, supermarkets, etc., even from the checkout staff to the delivery drivers on the front line working their asses off for survival. And then you just see people goofing around, jerking around. Yeah, you need a bit of light relief, but it kind of puts in perspective there's something wrong with society when you have footballers getting paid hundreds of thousands and now they're actually useless to society.
Well, they're getting paid an absolute fortune to literally do fuck all, because they're not even training, most of them.
Which kind of brings us on to point number three. I mean, there's obviously things people can do. Manchester United have said that they will continue to pay casual matchday staff, even if the remainder of the season is cancelled or if it's played behind closed doors. I think that's understood to be across 3,000 staff. That'll be like £1 million pounds to kind of cover, which is, that's when you're at that level of how much money the top clubs are making, people would say that's the least they could do. But it's also something that they're not obliged to do. I think, people, and this is going back to the players. I mean, I'm sure players do things behind the scenes. I mean, if I was a player, I wouldn't be tweeting, oh, I just donated 50 grand to, this dog charity or whatever. You just get on with it and help. You're not getting PR for it. I mean, Marcus Rashford has donated a significant fee to a charity to help provide meals for children affected by school closures. And this is the type of stuff that footballers really should be doing off their own backs and not seeking media attention. And by the way, I'm not saying Marcus Rashford has here. I'm just saying that's a good example of what footballers should be doing, rather than flicking fucking toilet paper around their house. Also, like Gary Neville and Giggs have opened up their hotels, haven't they, for free of charge for NHS staff. Similarly,
Hotel Chelsea Football have. And there's one in the centre of town, and there's the one at Stamford Bridge, isn't it? They're opening that up for NHS staff as well.
So that's the top of the football pyramid. Meanwhile, at the other end, you've got a real problem there, because a lot of, let's say the last two divisions, and then you also, let's say, the fifth tier, the National Conference, or whatever it's called now, these are clubs that need their matchday revenue to pay their staff. And this filters down to people losing their job. And there was an example of Barnet this week have put most of the club staff on notice, including the first team coaching and backroom staff and operational staff across all areas of the club. They were on parachute payments. I think they were relegated two seasons ago to non-league. So their parachute money expires. They're kind of where their business model was. We need to get promoted. Sounds familiar, actually. It's like the Villa Championship business model. We need to get promoted or the shit's going to hit the fan. So we kind of have an insight into that. But it, you know, that's the cutthroat nature. If you basically get rid of all your stuff now, it's basically a safety measure to whatever happens. And then if...
Well, I mean, the goal for these clubs is long-term survival. You know, if it's a bit of short-term pain, as they'd call it.
Yeah, when football does come back, they'll be saying to these people, hey, do you want a job? Basically, your old job. But, you know, that is the reality of the situation. I mean, the EFL have promised a £50 million kind of kitty across the board to help all clubs get over the short-term.
When you split that between quite a few clubs, that's not a lot of money.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Because the operating costs of some of those, especially the bigger championship clubs with essentially Premier League infrastructure around them, 50 million wouldn't even cover the top half of the championship potentially.
Yeah, I think it would be more spearheaded for the lower two leagues. Though,
yeah, it'd be the bottom two tiers,
because they're the ones that would be at risk of completely going out of business. Anyway, on to Aston Villa. As expected, Buddy Moore-Heath has been on shutdown all week, allowing players to isolate and you know, pretty much sort out with their families how they are going to continue henceforth. I think everybody will be on individual training programs. I mean, most of these players will have gyms in their house anyway. So actually keeping generally fit is not an issue. It's just obviously match fitness is something I'm sure they'll be looking at how they decide. I mean, for example, if football comes back April 30th, it's interesting to know how... And this is why it's not going to come back then. How the players get up to match fitness again and how they begin to train again, considering that isolation is key at the moment.
Because I know, like, I think Wolves are due back in training very soon. They've had, you know, some teams have had a few days off, they're letting them go back, and they'll kind of let them, now they know they've got a lot of time to play with, they'll probably let a few guys sort of come in dribs and drabs.
Yeah, maybe five-a-sides only, or two-a-sides. Or
one
something.
Interesting thing from the Villa side of things I saw with Trezeguet is that he's actually, with a lot of his other colleagues, have said that he's accepted a challenge of Syed Samir, who he plays with, and he is going to take care of the expenses of 40 families for the month to come, which I think is a really nice thing.
Wow.
To do with Ahmed Hegazi, obviously, who's at West Brom, and a lot of those guys.
Well, yeah, no, this is football. This is how it, you know, should be helping community at this stage. I mean, it's early days as well. People have only really started taking this seriously the last week or two, and the isolation is going to ramp up more seriously in the next few days. Update on season tickets. Obviously, they're not issuing early bird because the future is uncertain at the moment, so they don't know when the next season will be. I should put it up on the website. Behind the scenes, the Football Supporters Association have been contacting all the train companies and travel companies in terms of fans that may have already bought advance tickets, train tickets, travel tickets to games for the rest of the season, in terms of how they get their money back, what the situation is. Most, I think the feedback, if I remember rightly, is, you know, change. You normally have to pay like a £10 change charge or whatever on some tickets. That's been waived, and I think advance tickets will be, you'll be able to change them. But I'll put that up on the website too. Another thing in Villa news, you know, sad news, Villa related. Peter Whittingham spent 4 years at the club back, I think he left, was it 2007?
Yeah, he was a Youth Cup winner, wasn't he? He was in that sort of team that beat the, you know, the young Rooney Everton side with the, you know, the Moore brothers and a few other players.
I mean, he'd been in intensive care in hospital for a few days, and there'd been reports that he was dead, and you know, teammates of his tweeted about, you know, RIP, blah, 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 but he was actually still alive. I mean, this is another cautionary tale in terms of what you believe and what you should be kind of retweeting and spreading. But unfortunately, he did eventually pass away. I mean, it was a bizarre incident. It was a strange thing, because I thought, is this an illness? Because sometimes they don't talk about why they are in hospital or in intensive care. But it was a bizarre incident, wasn't it, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, look at the police report, he seemed to have been out just to watch the England-Wales Six Nations game, And yeah. he in a pub in Barry, and he just tragically fell down the stairs. And, you know, that was it. He never, I don't know.
Head injury, wasn't it?
Head injury. I don't know. You know, obviously, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but he never seemed to come round again. And unfortunately, he leaves behind a, you know, wife, children, pregnant wife as well. So,
yeah,
just very, very sad.
Especially in terms of what's happening now. And as you say, his young family and pregnant wife. I mean, at Villa, and he was one of these players that a bit like reminds me of Stephen Davis and even Gary Cahill to some extent. Young players that Villa managers at the time didn't have 100% faith in and let their contracts go. And Whittingham had about 50-odd games, just over a half century of games. And then they actually went on to prove themselves as players that were perhaps better than the players that were brought in some cases to replace them, because he's kind of known as a Cardiff legend. I mean, some people call him the club kingpin at one stage. I think he's made over like 400 appearances, scored around, I think, 85 goals over a 10-year period, which is, I mean, Villa, the amount of Villa legends or so-called Villa legends on social media, some of them have barely played 100 games. But this was a legit Cardiff City legend who I think he started off on the left as he was at Villa, and then he kind of displaced Joe Ledley, who was in the Cardiff team at that stage. Then he switched more centrally, but he scored some bangers. I mean, I was looking at some compilation videos earlier on today, and he looks like a different player to the one that I remember at Villa. I mean, obviously he was very young at that time.
Yeah, I remember at Villa, he was one of those players who he had lots of potential, and then just as we started to get good, it became apparent that he wasn't quite at the level, you know, that an O'Neill, you know, would require to push on at that time. You know, obviously he went on. He never sort of, you know, soared the heights, as it were, to become a real, you know, top Premier League player like Cahill did. But yeah, he's probably in a very similar mould to someone like a Stephen Davis, who was probably better than Villa realised he was, but at that time, yeah, at Villa, he probably had to go when he did.
I mean, saying that, I just realised those two names I mentioned were also under O'Neill. They were the exodus from O'Neill, and I mean,
yeah, it was the breakup of that O'Leary era team, wasn't it?
But I just remember Whittingham. He's like a niche player. I mean, O'Neill seemed to bring in sort of identikit players that were, you know, to play the counter-attacking game, you know, pacey, yeah, powerful, everything else. You know, Whittingham's left foot really would have offered something. I mean, sort of reminds me a bit like of a younger Hourihan. He's got that, you know, other than just both of them being left-footed, you know, there was always sort of product. There was always, you know, an assist. Yeah. There was always something like that.
He always had a great delivery, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he could hit them from outside the box as well, which I don't remember him doing at Villa.
And I think he only scores it like maybe one goal at Villa. You know, with a lot of Villa players, you kind of remember those eras. And I think that, you know, the goal scoring player that everyone remembers from his era that was probably similar to him was Hitzlsperger. You know, had the rocket of a left foot, but actually chipped in with goals. And he was probably ahead of him just at that period, and they both left at a very similar time as well, didn't they?
Yeah, but yeah, as Phil was saying, they're kind of players that are not the functional player. Actually, you know, the functional player that gives you 100% running around. There's a bit more individuality about them. If that's, I don't know if that is accurate.
No, I'd
maybe
go along
a bit
with that.
Slight, a bit, lightweight. I think was
yeah,
his
he was. He was lightweight, and it was because he played on the wing.
O'Neill
at Villa. Yeah, because he played on the wing for Villa. He never had that like blistering pace that, of course, he would have essentially was replaced with a young Ashley Young at that time,
yeah,
who at that point was ultimately head and shoulders better than him. And has, you know, clearly gone on to have a much better career. So it was probably proven at the time to be a, you know, the right decision. But yeah, just a really sad way for a player who, you know, ultimately, you know, does he go down as a Villa legend? No, but he's one of those players that nobody would have a bad word to say about him either, I don't think.
No, I mean, it's more he is a Cardiff City legend, but his roots are at Villa. I mean, it's a very sad age, 35. So our thoughts are with his family at this time, especially his wife. Moving on, I just want to say thank you very much for the My Old Man Said patrons, as usual, in these difficult times, to obviously help keep us going. Lots of things planned despite this situation in terms of bonus podcasts coming up, as well as the usual usual extra more reactionary ones. I'll be doing a few solo ones on various things through my own Men's Head history, like the origin story and various behind-the-scenes scuffles with the club. And
there are a couple of corkers in there.
The FA, etc. If you're new to the My Old Man universe, I mean, obviously, some of our listeners would have been in there from the start, so and they're very much part of the foundations that My Old Man said were kind of built on. I mean, it makes me laugh. Some people still just think My Old Man said's just like a Facebook page or something. We're going on for like 10 years now, I think. I think next year's the 10th year anniversary, so some good stuff there. Also coming up, we're putting together a few little tricks that we used to do. I think older listeners will know. Let's put it this way: we've used the parts from the Scott Hogan touch count meter to rebuild the time machine that we used to get in. I don't think Bud's ever been in the time machine. I don't know how he's going to react to it. We shall find out. But we've got a decent episode coming up. Hopefully we can record it in the next couple of days and have it out next week. And if that goes down well, then there'll be more of those production numbers to come. But thank you very much to patrons and the ones that have signed up since the last show: Matthew Smith, Lily, Chris Hill, Michael Smith, Wes Roach, Adam Kelly, Doug, and a big thanks also to Stephen Martin as well for signing up most recently. Also, I forgot over the last few episodes to give shout outs to the people who support us as Facebook supporters. So just a shout out for some of the recent ones that I haven't mentioned over the last few weeks. And indeed months. Leslie Dyke, Neil Gardner, Matthew Allen, James McQueen, and also Russ Wilson. A massive thanks. And thank you, Russ, for that message as well, because I would have completely forgot to give you guys a shout out. Please do go to myoldmansaid.com and check out the Patreon option and do support us in these times, and we will give you a load more shows during this isolation period.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And that brings us to how this break will impact on Aston Villa. I mean, let's look at the context of it. We're at Wembley. I mean, the good news is, and we, you know, you've got to be thankful for it. Well, at least 33,500 of us who went to Wembley, at least we've had a big day out, like a proper Villa fun day out, and saw a decent game and a performance that actually gave us optimism. So we have that to be thankful for. The problem was the next game we played dissipated all of that optimism in terms of it looks like we've got some fighting spirit to make a fist of the end of the season, and against Leicester, complete capitulation. But also just question marks about Dean Smith, like real question marks started to pop up. Like, you've managed to play Leicester in two games in, you know, we're talking competitive games, in a cup semi-final, playing certain systems.
And very recently as well.
And very recently. And then you revert back to a formation pretty much that got us spanked at Villa Park against them, and we pretty much got the same result. We conceded four goals. So you're thinking, what? It's a bit naive.
Has that been like probably the key word of the whole season though?
Yeah. But before we get into that, because obviously we've gone over that ground so many times, then there was reports that Chelsea was a game that may decide his future. I mean, you get that all the time. Once a manager's on a bit of a bad run, it's always like, oh, he has the next game to prove himself. I don't think the way that Purslow, from my experiences of talking face-to-face to Purslow, when I've ever dropped a question mark above Smith's head, the answer has always been a reinforced answer that it's very much he is long term. So I could never really see Smith going at the end of the season. What I could see was if we did get relegated and it was in the style of that Leicester game, pretty much relegated with a whimper, then I think the fans would have made up the decision for the club at the end of the season, and I could see Smith going. If we go down battling, you know, every inch, you know, we're up against teams that are survival clubs, as I've called them in previous podcasts, where they are just built to survive in the Premier League, and that is the extent of their ambition. But when you're built to survive, you're pretty resolute, and as all these teams have shown, you know, they've beaten all these top 10 teams, and we've only beaten Burnley in the top half of the league. That shows we're a bit of a soft touch, and you know, while we've played very well against some of these teams, and that Wembley Cup final was an example of how we've been gallant but ultimately came up short. You look at Wigan beating Manchester City and getting relegated in the same season. This is a Wigan team that had a way of winning. And even though they were gallant, they could beat anybody. They just, in the end, I think, problem with Wigan, they had, because of their cup run, they had so much fixture congestion that they just couldn't mentally keep beating teams. They were playing three games in a week, and you just knew, even though they could beat anybody on their day, it was just too much to do. This Villa team, though, against Leicester, that's when you start to think, well, is this how it's going to be? Because we've done that again. You know, we did that against Watford in games that you really need to win. And in the early part of the season, Smith was pretty good at getting his team to win the games that we needed to win. So that's the context. And then suddenly this virus happens and the league's shut down. So, I mean, everything we're going to talk about really is hypothetical, because we're assuming this season will kick off again. So let's start with that conversation. So, Phil, how do you think this situation is impacted on Villa? I mean, has it given Smith a second chance? Has it given the whole club a second chance to actually get out of this situation? I mean, what's your reading of the situation if it's to continue?
Yeah, well, I mean, if it is going to be the 10-game summer shootout that people are expecting, you know, it's only an advantage to Aston Villa. For, I mean, looking at the Leicester game, I mean, it was like abandon all hope. That was really the outcome of the Leicester game. I mean, it was, you know, you lost faith in the coaching staff. You lost faith in the players. I mean, everything that could have went wrong in that game. I mean, even Samata had an early chance, and you thought to yourself, you know, these are the sort of chances he's burying, and he just put it wide. And so now you come out of that game depressed. All our relegation rivals will be thinking, well, don't worry about Villa, they're going to finish bottom, let alone you know, anywhere near us. Then this break happens, and we still don't know whether this break's going to be a short break, a long break, or even permanent if they do end up having to void the league. But you're now looking at a 10-game shootout with a Villa team that, like, get them into the dressing room, get them somewhere, say, right, whatever's gone before, clean slate, scrap it, let's go again. With McGinn coming in, you know, it's only an advantage to us.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I mean, a lot of people have said on social media that cup run has saved us because it means we have a game to play, so they can't really just close the league off as it is and say, right, Liverpool champions, you guys in Europe, you guys relegated. I don't think they can do that anyway, really, because you start the league under the understanding it's X amount of games, and it's where you lie after 38 games that determines if you get relegated or not. This is my opinion. I can't see them closing off the league as it is, especially with Villa with a game in hand, but I don't think they could do that anyway.
I think as things stand, it's probably, that's ultimately the last resort, isn't it? But they will look at it as, you know, if we do this, what will happen in terms of this? And they'll be thinking, well, a lot of people you've heard in sort of media say, well, you can give Liverpool the title because they've as good as won it. Well, mathematically they haven't, but it's they're kind of isolated anyway. You know, it doesn't really change anything for them. Yeah. But when you start getting a couple of places down, all of a sudden you're looking at things becoming fair or unfair and the sort of integrity of the competition. It's like, well, if Leicester, who've had an amazing season by any standards, and the fact that where they were last year and how much they've improved, they're thoroughly deserving of, you know, that place in the Champions League. And then you go a bit further down and you're thinking, well
this is it. It's high stakes.
Stakes all the way down. And then you get to the bottom and it becomes even more high stakes, because if in the event that Villa were to get relegated, Villa would have a pretty solid case in court to say, all right, we'll have our 170 million then, please.
Yeah.
Because in terms of like the prestige of the league, it's like, is it about the prestige of the league? Well, you know, with all honesty, no. It's about the money.
Yeah, the Liverpool thing's no real big issue. It's the European places and it's the relegation places, because...
And then it's the league below, of course, as well. It's the thing of, yes, some people have said, oh, well, let Leeds and West Brom come up. It's like, well, if you do that, you're going to get four lawsuits from the likes of Brentford, Forest, and the other sides in the playoff positions, because they're going to go, well, we didn't get a fair crack at the whip for the third place. Or even if Leeds and West Brom weren't allowed up, then you're in the position of them going, well, hang on a minute. We've just missed out on 100 and something million quid for a club like Leeds, and the financial shitstorm they've been in for the best part of, what, 15 years or more? Well, it's more, isn't it? That will reinvigorate that club.
Yeah, other Championship fans will say, well, let's look at Leeds, and they had even a better lead or start to a season last year and still buggered it up. And there's a reason why people sing Leeds Are Falling Apart again, the Joy Division song, because that's what they do, and they do it very well.
Yeah, don't we enjoy it?
And football, as most sports, it deals, and the beauty of football is the finality of it. It's Liverpool, I mean, for example, last season, if there was a catastrophe, and it happened after the first leg of that knockout round where Liverpool played Barcelona in the Champions League. And Liverpool had lost the first leg 3-0, and then some catastrophe happened, and they say, right, okay, we're going to start the Champions League again, but I don't think we have time to play the second leg. And they'll go, well, Barcelona are 3-0 up first leg. There's no way Liverpool are going to claw that back. And most people will go, well, you know, that's fair enough. But this is football, and
exactly,
and this is sport, and miracles do happen. And I'm not saying Liverpool are going to blow the league, but are they on a losing run at the moment? I think they are, aren't they?
They're not having a particularly great run.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but we should deal with finality, if that is even a word.
And in terms of the rest of the league, all the other sort of permutations are very close. It's like, you know, you got your very extreme Villa fans will say, oh, it's going to be a miracle if we stay up from here. But the essential thing is you're one game or one win away from getting out of the bottom three. It's not miracle stakes yet. We're in a bad position and we've played ourselves into trouble. But it's still in our own hands, and we can, and we're more than capable of getting out of trouble.
And that game is against Sheffield United. And if we win that, it's not the greatest win ever in the history of Villa. And in the context of relegation escapes, it will be seen as no real big deal. So,
yeah, and to be fair, on paper,
we need a miracle over 10 games.
Yeah, when you look at those fixture lists in like last June, you're looking down at it going, right, we've got Sheffield United then. Right, we're going to need to beat those teams that came up with us. You're not thinking about Sheffield United at that point in terms of, well, they're going to be challenging for, you know. Yeah. Well, the reality is that they'd have a cast iron case if Man City got banned from Europe and they beat Villa in their game in hand, they'd be in the Champions League places.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much to play for. And I think just morally as a Villa fan, I think everybody obviously wants Villa to stay up, but you want Villa to have deserved to stay up.
Yeah.
I certainly do. It's like, well, if you stay up by default, well, so be it. But it's like, it's not a particularly credible way to stay in the division.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm not that bothered. If we can stay up by any means necessary, I'll take it at this juncture. So, I know exactly what you're saying. At the same time, people have, you know, they're coming up with these theories of how do you resolve this situation. Some people have said, right, let's condense this into like some neutral ground shootout, neutral grounds as in to limit the effects of not having, you know, basically closed, behind closed doors, neutral venues. And you just think, that's thinking too hard. Because, yeah. You're taking, Villa's only chance of survival, by the way, is hopefully...
midweek games at Villa Park.
Villa Park will play a big role in this, because we will have to pull out victories against, or points from the, you know, against the likes of Manchester United, Chelsea's, etc. So that takes away, suddenly we're a disadvantage by this proposition of the neutral venues. There's also the league finishes, you promote West Brom and promote Leeds. Because they are, I think, 6 points clear in the mm-hmm. instant, you give Liverpool the title. And you play next season with 22 teams, which the Premier League used to be, well, the top tier certainly did once upon a time. And then next season you relegate 5. That's fine, I think, in theory. I don't know how that pans out for the rest of the divisions. I mean, we haven't had a look at that. But then you've still got the European places, and there is a big, you know, there's not that many points separating teams that up there. And there's a big difference if you make the Champions League and you don't. it could transform a club like Sheffield United or Wolves, for example.
And in that you go down a division and it's the same. You know, you look at someone like Brentford, who are back in the playoff positions for the first time, well, since Smith was at the club. And you're thinking, well, if they don't go up, they will get raided. If they were to go up for the first time ever, they're probably thinking, actually, we can keep our players and build something. You know, you're looking at Fulham, who have kept a lot of the players that they got relegated with. I think they're in third position currently.
Yeah.
They'll be looking at it going, this is our opportunity to keep the likes of Mitrovic, Kearney, people like that. Financially, we know we get ourselves out of trouble, and then we're back up and running again, and we can sort of rebuild and improve in a Premier League, which, you know, is potentially what Villa may end up having to do. But you know, they somehow managed to keep their best players.
Yeah. What is what's the cricket thing when it rains?
The Duckworth Lewis.
Yeah,
that wouldn't work in Villa's favour either.
I was thinking, is there a Duckworth solution to this? And I was thinking, there's no way we come out of that good.
Not on our recent run of form.
Mm.
And
first halves.
Yeah.
We used to do all right.
Yeah, so I don't know if they divided the points by the number of games, for example, that would be the simplest way, and we'd be shafted. And obviously the whole home away and the permutations and nuances involved does not make it a fair reflection of what could happen. So I think, virus willing, that they will aim to play out the rest of the season up until, well, this is the thing, when you got next season, when you start to park it into next season, then you've got an issue. You've got a transfer
ultimately,
window.
We're in a fluid position. We don't know where we're at. You know, if everything kind of works as I think they hope it will, they're probably thinking they will start the season back up when they would have normally finished it potentially. And then you're thinking, well, if you can get through the end of May, June to get 10 rounds of fixtures, well, 11 in Villa's case, you're probably looking, you're going to need, what, a six-week period of like every Saturday with some midweeks as well, allowing teams to have a little bit of a seven-day break in between certain points. Obviously, that isn't going to play in Villa's hands.
I think you're not a seven-day break in it. I think you're playing midweek and
well, you're going to have to. You know, I mean, at some point in that run of games over 6 weeks, you know, if you're playing 10 games, you are going to have a certain amount of break in between games, or you can space them out. You don't even have to always play Saturday. Like, you know, you could, in theory, play every 4 days.
Yeah.
Yeah, the order, you know, the people were going, oh, it's a hard 2 games for Villa here, it's a hard 3 games in a row. Suddenly that order's out the window. We could be playing these 10 teams that we'll have to play. We could be playing them in any order. I mean, you could end up with United, Liverpool, Chelsea, you know, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday.
But I think once it gets to a certain point where you can't really finish it before the next season starts, and obviously you've got transfer window to factor in and end of contracts, then I think the only other option is just avoid the whole season and then just focus on the next season. Obviously you want it nice and tidy, but there is that point where if the situation worsens and it's unrealistic to play any games, and you can't take chances and go, well, we've got to do this because think about the money, and it's just inconvenient not to do it. I think
it's funny, isn't it, because
you've got to avoid it.
Yeah, some people are arguing, oh, you know, continuity and all that sort of stuff of the competition. But most of the arguments that people are having are basically money. You know, when people talk about, you know, relegation, Europe, what about the legal shitstorm? People aren't talking about a legal shitstorm because they are desperate about one place in the Premier League. They're bothered about the difference between earning, what is it, 3 or 4 million at the top of the Championship in TV money or 170 million in the Premier League. Or the difference, you know, in hundreds of millions in the Champions League, it basically comes down to money.
And the news flash is, up until a certain point, the UK government were taking the stance towards this virus with the theory of herd immunity. So essentially, let 60% of the population get it. That builds up immune system and onward and upwards. The problem is when, who is it, the Imperial College?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who were running the models, because they can run these models. Basically, it's a computer program that shows you if you take certain actions, this is how it pans out for you. You know, they were showing a quarter of a million dying if you take these steps. And that's within 24 hours, they switched to replicating what's going on pretty much mainland Europe.
And all over the world.
And here we are in self-isolation because that was the newsflash. Herd immunity, and you're going to have a quarter of a million dead on your hands. And when I said earlier on about they are getting quotes for as well as, you know, ventilation units, but also mobile morgues, essentially, and incinerators and stuff, it's not easy to get rid of 250,000 people who have died in quick. They're, you know, buying up a land as well. And this is not something you take lightly. This is how serious it is. And when you're thinking, oh, yeah, well, we should be able to finish it in June, blah, oh, you know, we've got to finish it and blah, blah, blah. It's of zero significance. And it's just going to be a matter of insurance companies, and the finances will go out the window, and a lot of people will be stung, and a lot of it will be all about crisis management and damage limitation in terms of finances.
You know, and a lot of people, yeah, you'll be thinking, you know, there's the health factor, you know, there's the economic meltdown that's happening as well. And you're thinking, if people are losing jobs, livelihoods, deep down, are people actually going to, If you know, in a much worse case than as we think it might go, but if it goes towards that side of things, are people even going to give a shit?
No, exactly.
I mean, to be brutally honest, after the shit show at Leicester, I've just been like, do you know what? I'm quite glad of the break from Villa.
But it's not even the case of that. It's just football per se. It's nothing.
It's just not a priority.
It's zero priority. This is the situation. It's like these will be proper decisions, not we've got to try to wedge in and finish the season. If it can't be finished, then to void the season and you have to start the season again, but you'll have a transfer window. Clubs will complain, you know, the teams in the championship who wanted to get promoted and they're going to miss out on the pie. Maybe there'll be legal cases there. But
or you just don't have a transfer window. Clubs can't sell. So it's...
What will a judge say? They will say, well, people are dying. We've just lost, you know. We're talking about people are fighting over toilet paper in supermarkets now. Imagine it a month, 2 months down the line. Where, you know, you could be walking into hell, and football is pretty inconsequential. And, you know, people should be worried. And I don't really want to make them even more worried. But all I'm saying is just...
It's just perspective, isn't it?
You've got to be realistic mm-hmm. and practical, and football is not the be-all and end-all. As a fan, it will be a hard bullet to take if your team does not get promoted. I mean, I'm not just talking from a point of view of a fan whose team is in the relegation zone at the moment and won't get relegated because the season will be voided. I mean, that's just too fucking small-time thinking. The upshot is, at the moment, I think that April the 30th is... it's just... the next step of...
Yeah, it's just a bookmark, isn't it? The strange thing with all of this is I can't... Well, clearly, in my lifetime, I can never remember there being no global sport. There's always been something, you know, even when there's been like little, like, you know, when there was SARS or foot and mouth or, like, you know, swine flu and things like this, they'd be relatively regional and therefore, or if there were like problems with, I remember there was like an NBA shutout and things like that, but there's never been anything in that, to my knowledge, where the whole of global sport has just shut down completely.
Yeah, maybe virtual sports and gaming will be the become the new sports, but I think even Netflix said they're going to take down their resolution to free up a bit of bandwidth because obviously everybody's on the internet now. Sorry, Phil.
No, esports, I think they've been shut down as well because the way it's heading, it's not, you know, it's not people sitting in their, you know, their living rooms playing. They're looking to get teams together and, you know,
they're playing arenas.
Yeah, Barcelona have an esports team and I'm sure Villa are heading that way eventually.
Yeah, I know the guys I work with at Formula E, they do a thing before every major race where the punters can actually race against the actual drivers on the track, you know, in a virtual version of the race. It's crazy.
Yeah, maybe the Scott Hogan touch camp will be the only form of sporting activity out, competitive sporting activity out there. Right, anything else to add apart from making sure everybody you stay safe and don't go crazy out there?
Phil, how do you... how do you think the extended gap actually works in Villa's favour? Do you think it's a case that Smith can go away, reflect, they can all do that? I mean, obviously every team is in a position to do that now, but in terms of, do you think Smith's currently sat doing a bit of soul searching and working out, hang on, where's this, well, a year on, where has this gone wrong? And do I have to really sort of rethink my plan here or refocus? Or
this is where I had my doubts over Smith. I mean, that's what I said, the doubts after that Watford away game. I really had problems after that. You know, he won me over again, and then now I'm heading back there. It might be fickle, but I mean, you know, the concerns never went away that he's stubborn. He thinks by doing things the right way that it'll work out eventually. I'm just hoping that he doesn't become stubborn with a tactical plan again. You know, he does sort of change. I mean, after in the Leicester game, if he had of seen the way it was going, he should have done something to switch to a back three, because he knows that that nullified Leicester the last two times. Yeah. But I hope he's not just pinning his hopes on McGinn having the same effect that Grealish coming back last season
but
did.
Phil, the finger of blame is starting to be pointed at Suso, the sporting director. Does Smith actually have a squad at his disposal that are good enough to get him out of this? And as I've said, other teams around us are survival teams, and they have been in the Premier League for a couple of seasons, at least most of them. And so they have Premier League ready squads. Well, you look down ours and there's an assortment of, you know, mid-level championship team, former teams that were mid-level championship teams or Belgium teams. And there's a question mark over the calibre of some of these players. Is it right that the finger of blame should be pointed at recruitment, and does he have the team to get us out of here? Are they too young, etc.?
I think they're too, I don't want to say too soft, because it's a word that's going to be used again and again. I mean, Keenan Davis, when I think it was what led to Leicester's third goal. Johnny Evans had just made a sliding tackle on the edge of their box. He was still on the ground. Keenan Davis was on his feet with the ball at his feet, and he managed to run into Johnny. He wasn't up for the tackle there, and Keenan Davis probably the strongest player we have. Yeah. There's just, I mean, I don't know. I go back to training. I mean, if you're training with players that, you know, maybe that pressure isn't being put on in training in the matches they play against each other, in the match situations, then maybe it's sort of carrying over to the pitch that they think, oh, the referee will give me that decision, you know, if I do the right things in the pitch, rather than, you know, putting a bit, sort of doing the nasty things, doing the dirty work on the pitch that somebody needs to. And I think that comes from Smith, unfortunately.
I mean, you're looking at with hindsight now, and I mean, this is something we grumbled about earlier on in terms of the recruitment. Should they have been a bit more tried and tested Premier League experience? Because that's what we said Heaton was. And then you look around the rest of the team and it's not really there. And you've got Jack as the captain. So you're kind of hoping that, and from a captain's point of view, it's like the inspiration of, you know, the Grealish razzle and dazzle that will hopefully shine off to the rest of the team. But then you look at who's the real leader, and you're looking at Mings. And Mings, with all due respect, hasn't had that many games in the Premier League. So it's not like he's not the old guard. He's not like a tried and trusted Premiership level, and he's composed. And because, you know, Mings, as we've discussed on the show, and as most fans have said, he does have a moment every other game or every game where perhaps, you know, he does panic sometimes, and he hasn't got that experience because he's been injured a lot. So that cuts down the amount of game time experience that he's acquired over his career. And as we saw in January, they purposely brought in Pepe Reina and Drinkwater to give us that experience. But you looked at them and you thought, are they just like cannon fodder for our relegation?
Well, they're very cheap plasters, aren't they, to put over the cut, but they're not going to get to the root problem, I wouldn't have said.
I go back to the summer and, you know, the players that were let go, I think it's been proven that we couldn't have kept any of them. None of them have went on to do anything. Most of them, you know, most of them aren't really playing anymore, which is even worse.
And they were too old, or they're not good enough.
But then you sort of look at, you know, who do we sign? I mean, we're not here to play like a computer game and say, oh, I want to sign this guy and this guy. But the players really aren't there. I mean, I think we're missing a player like Billing for Bournemouth. Anytime he's played against us, he's been the difference. But who else do you buy? I mean, we were talking about Peter Whittingham earlier on. You know, the team that he was only maybe a bit part player of, whenever Smith said, when I look around at the bench, I see quality. It doesn't compare if you had, you know, Peter Whittingham, a good top-tier championship player on the bench. I mean, we don't have even top-tier championship players on the bench. Yeah.
You look at our squad, and generally speaking, bar a couple of sort of spatterings of quality, it's a squad of squad players.
Yeah, Courtney Hawes couldn't even get in the Wolves team, struggled to get on the bench.
No, and again, he'd had injury problems. It's kind of like, you look at where a lot of these players came from. You know, we've very seldom gone and bought the best player from a half-decent club. You know, you look back to, you know, years gone by, you know, when we went and bought someone like Stan Collymore from Liverpool, at that time, that was a marquee signing. Or when we went, you know, dipped into South America and bought Juan Pablo Angel, put one of the best centre forwards in South America at one of the biggest clubs on that continent. You know, thinking these are marquee signings.
Because at the moment, the recruitment seems to be, where can we get value with potential sell-on sell on value.
Well, it's this money ball thing that we've spoken about before, isn't it? It's naive.
It's not naive. It's run by business. It's run by economics, which sometimes don't relate to football. Because, for example, you could go and get a player who's 31 who... face value, there's no sell on there. That's like a cul-de-sac. But he could probably give you the best two seasons of his career. And that lifts the team, even though you don't make any more money on him. But obviously, that's a gamble. You may just get a player who's like, oh, I'm too old for this shit. And he'll just collect the money, as we've seen with many of our players. But, you know, that's down to the recruitment to get the to analyze the mentality of the person and see what the drive, you know, see what's left in the tank. And as fans, it's hard for us to do that because you can't sit down with the players and go, right, you know, what are you all about? Are you somebody who just wants to walk in with the Louis Vuitton wash bag and act the role of a professional footballer without naming any names of the current Villa team that don't actually spend much time on the grass, but live the life?
What, the Lansbury lifestyle, you mean?
As I said, I'm not mentioning any names.
I agree with what Phil said, in that you're looking at the pool of players that Villa potentially had at their disposal. And I think, well, did Villa maybe do potentially as good a business as they were going to be able to? We spent a lot of money, you know, net spend, but in terms of the business we had to do, when you break it down at £10 million a player at Premier League value, that isn't a lot. Then you look at what our realistic wage structure is. And Christian Perslow alluded to this in January, that Villa can't even compete in terms of wages with teams like Burnley at the moment. We're not established in the Premier League for long enough to be able to restructure, you know, transfer fees. That just comes straight out of the TV money. It's kind of like, it's money in, it's money out. Thank you very much. Your wage structure comes from building up the whole club. You know, you look at what Villa's highest earners, they're generally speaking, by terms of a big team, very average. I mean, you look at why Abraham is turning down his Chelsea contract, because he wants to be treated like the main man at Chelsea. And you think, well, is Tammy Abraham a potentially 150, 200 grand a week player? Absolutely not. But that's the current lunacy of where the market is. And whether we like it or not, Villa can't compete there yet. There's potential that they can in the future, but you've got to build, you know, Tammy Abraham aside. I actually think something like Chelsea's, you know, it's funny how some of these things sometimes work for clubs against clubs. Chelsea's transfer embargo, long term, will probably benefit them.
Yeah.
Because the value of Abraham, Mount, Tomori, these kind of players, is going to skyrocket.
And hence what you've said about Perslow in recent previous podcasts about this emphasis on the academy, because that's the business model they want.
That's their long goal. You know, Villa's owners, you know, as much as we want to stay up and, you know, everyone is very much in the here and the now. These guys are rich enough. They're thinking 10 years. They're playing a very long game because they're rich enough to be able to do that. Fans don't think, oh, well, I'll take the short-term pain this season, but in 10 years we'll be great. You know, with everything going on in the world right now, everyone's thinking, oh, where the hell are we going to be in 10 years? Everyone wants, everything now, and everybody wants instant gratification and success. And
on that note, I think it's time to wrap up. We have other shows to record over the weekend, so I'll keep you up to date with them. There'll be a flurry of extra shows as well, so please do sign up to be a patron. And also make sure, if you listen on Spotify and Apple, to subscribe as well, so you know when the shows drop, because at the moment we will not be running to a structure of we will drop a show after a game, because there are no games, but we will be as frequent, if not more frequent, because isolation gives you a little time on your hands.
You can time to be creative, David.
Exactly. So please do stay with us, and the next few shows will give you a slice of what is to come in these weird old times. Stay safe, wash your hands, as everybody says, but there's a reason for that. Try to avoid contact with people in supermarkets, and up the Villa. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.